We go to Mexico City now, where rescue efforts continue following the 7.1 magnitude earthquake that struck on Tuesday. The death toll is now past 200, including 19 children who died when a primary school collapsed. In just a minute, we'll take a closer look at the vulnerable infrastructure in schools across Mexico and across much of the rest of the world, too. Meanwhile, in Mexico City, volunteers from neighborhood after neighborhood have been working feverishly to help their fellow citizens, including one group called Los Topos, born out of the devastation of the earthquake in Mexico City in 1985. Maya Croth is a freelance journalist based in Mexico City, and she joins me now. Maya, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Ted.
Well, you've been out in the streets and in the neighborhoods during the recovery efforts. What have you been seeing on this fourth day after the earthquake?
A lot of outpouring of support from just average everyday Mexicans who have been coming down to donation centers, bringing medicine and all kinds of supplies, but going so far as putting on a hard hat and work boots and picking up a pickaxe and going into the disaster sites. I think that's one of the most interesting things about the scene here is how much the civilian segment of the population is involved in the response.
Now, there's one particular group in Mexico City who's been responding here that a lot of people probably haven't heard of. They're called Los Topos, and you got some sound of some of the volunteers near some of the different sites talking about Los Topos. Listen.
We are very proud of every Mexican who's doing their part to help. The Topos are a great example of people helping out and not expecting anything in return. They're volunteers, and if we have extra time, we can help them. They go where no one else can, and they've rescued a lot of people. Sometimes you can't even see anything in the rubble, just a bit of a nose or a hand, and if it weren't for the Topos, a lot of people wouldn't be here.
Who are Los Topos?
Los Topos is a name that's applied to a group, maybe about six or seven different groups that are all largely civilian groups that are nonprofit. They're not associated with the government. And the fact that they're completely volunteer makes them heroes to a lot of people here in Mexico. They're among the first responders to earthquake disasters, not only in Mexico, but around the world. And they grew out of something that happened after the big quake of 1985 here in Mexico, where a public housing project in a neighborhood called Tlatelolco collapsed, and neighbors grew really frustrated with the slow response on the part of the authorities and just started to go in themselves, go into the rubble and see if they could save anybody and see what they could find. And in the 32 years since, they've grown into kind of an elite civilian force. They have extensive training. They've developed methods for rescuing people that I think may be unique in the world of search and rescue, mostly involving building tunnels and finding people that way. In fact, their name translates to mole in Spanish. So topos means moles.
The moles.
Yeah, and they burrow into places that other people can't get to.
Well, you were out in the neighborhoods and you spoke to Liana Maria Barrera, who really reflected the admiration that people have for Los Topos.
I thank God that there are people who are that brave to offer their lives because they are in danger too. These people are risking their lives to save a brother, and that is priceless.
Maya Croth, you also mentioned, though, that Los Topos came out of frustration with the government and with the response after 1985. What are people seeing today when they look at the government response, when they look at their president, Enrique Peña Nieto?
In general, the response I've seen on social media and on the ground is not super positive. And I don't think that's unusual. This is not a very popular president. You do see a large presence of different federal agencies, government agencies, military, and for the most part, they are keeping things calm and orderly. But we are also hearing reports here and there that the collaboration with civilian forces like the Topos is not going as smoothly as some might hope.
Maya Croth is a freelance journalist in Mexico City. Maya, thanks for the update.
Thank you, Todd.
Among the worst tragedies, 19 children and 6 teachers died when a primary school collapsed in Mexico City's southern Coapa district. All across the world, schools can be especially vulnerable in earthquakes. The 2005 earthquake in Pakistan destroyed 7,000 schools. And in 2008, more than 5,000 students were killed after a 7.9 magnitude quake struck the Sichuan province in China. Janice Rogers spends a lot of her time trying to figure out why schools can be so vulnerable to collapse in earthquake zones, sometimes even more vulnerable than the buildings around them. Rogers is chief operating officer of Geohazards International. That's a group working to limit losses when earthquakes strike.
Sometimes schools are more vulnerable than other buildings, and sometimes they're less vulnerable, and that depends on the construction type. But if buildings are the same type, schools have certain features that can make them more vulnerable to collapse. Those include larger rooms and other configuration patterns that are unique to schools, like large windows that often have columns next to them that can be damaged in earthquakes.
What other features do schools typically have that can make them more vulnerable?
Older schools in particular were not designed to modern earthquake-resistant codes, and this makes them vulnerable. And this is true in many places around the world. We see new schools being built well with earthquake-resistant design, but the older schools that predate those codes would be vulnerable. And they're also, in many cases, schools have been built with materials that we know perform poorly in earthquakes. For example, unreinforced masonry. That could be brick, it could be stone, but those types of schools have performed poorly in past earthquakes.
Is that largely because in many places that are short on resources, when governments or neighborhoods build a school, they build it as cheaply as possible?
That can happen. Masonry is frequently locally available, but it also had to do with the people not understanding the hazard many, many years ago when schools were constructed. There are many unreinforced masonry schools that existed in California, for example, prior to the 1933 Long Beach earthquake, which occurred early in the morning, but led to the damage and collapse of many, many schools in that area. So in that case, that was just how they built schools until they discovered, unfortunately, that that type of building doesn't do well in earthquakes.
So that was in the 30s in California. But where in the world is this most a problem with schools built either improperly or with unreinforced materials?
There are a lot of places where there are a large number of unsafe school buildings. Certainly in South Asia, where we work, there are many, many schools that are older and that are vulnerable. That's one area, but it's not alone. We also work in Haiti, where there are many vulnerable schools, and there are a number of other countries around the world with vulnerable schools. And of course, we still have vulnerable schools here in the United States.
Is there any way to know how many schools here in the States might be vulnerable? You have to be near a fault line or an earthquake zone, of course, and not built to code, I guess.
Right. And there have been efforts to determine the number of vulnerable schools in a number of states with appreciable earthquake hazard. And first, the typical way this is done is by looking at how old the schools are and what type of building they are. Again, unreinforced masonry is a type that would immediately raise concerns, as well as reinforced concrete buildings that are older than the certain age when modern codes came into force.
So do states or counties or jurisdictions typically check for this kind of thing, or is it a case where they wait for tragedy to strike?
I think many states have been proactive, and there have been programs at state level, for example, in Oregon. Also, there's been work in Utah, in Alaska, in Washington, and also certainly at the school district level. A lot of this work is done locally, and it can be motivated by parents that are concerned about the safety of their children's schools.
Still, Janice Rogers, it's one thing for parents or communities in the United States or Canada to demand retrofitting of schools where their communities may have those resources. Around the world where communities don't have those resources, what does it take to make a school quake-resistant if it isn't already? What can be done?
Well, there are a number of lower-cost seismic retrofit strategies. An example would be in Nepal. We worked with a local nonprofit organization in Nepal called the National Society for Earthquake Technology, And as part of our project back in the late 1990s, they retrofitted the first school in Nepal. And since then, they've gone on to retrofit more than 300. And the vast majority of those schools did very, very well in the 2015 earthquake. And the techniques that were used were lower costs, could be accomplished with some government funding or outside agency funding, and a lot of community participation, community donation of labor and of materials. And so it was affordable to do. And there are now many more schools being retrofitted in Nepal.
And do you generally find when you go to a community and warn of schools that could be vulnerable to collapse that those communities listen? I mean, I ask it because so often it seems like countries, communities don't react until tragedy has already struck.
What we found in our practice is that schools are just one of the most motivating things. People care about their children's safety, and they're more willing to invest in a school than they would be in even their own home.
Janice Rogers of GeoHazards International, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.